WICN in Worcester, this is the Venture Forum, tales of entrepreneurship from central Massachusetts. I'm your host, Mark Reed Edwards, Executive Director of the Venture Forum. Now let's start today's tale. This week's guest on the Venture Forum is Paul Silva, General Partner at Launch 413 in Western Massachusetts. Launch 413 takes startups to their first $10 million in revenue. The organization is made up of serial entrepreneurs and veteran executives dedicated to helping startups become profitable engines of prosperity in the Western Mass region. That's music to my ears. Paul, it is great to have you on the Venture Forum.
It's great to be with you, Mark. Thanks for inviting me.
Can you share a bit about your background and career and what led you to launch 413?
Sure. Well, it was a clear and obvious line of sight, like anything is in life, right? Yeah. I was once a physicist and then discovered that I was going to have to work really hard to be a mediocre physicist and fell in love with this idea of starting my own video game company. And then I was smart enough to realize I didn't stand a chance in that industry unless I picked a really interesting niche. So I did. And so my first company, All in Play, a little over 20 years ago, made video games for the blind, which was an amazing experience. It was a master's degree education in how to not build a startup.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of good for the blind and visually impaired community in the world, and lost all my aunts and uncles' money. They still love me. They donated to a charity to help the blind, is what they told me. They had hoped that it wouldn't be that at the beginning. That got me started down the entrepreneurial journey. Then I helped start the entrepreneurship program at my college, UMass Amherst. And then from that led to creating a mentoring program that transcended the college, which would go on to become Valley Venture Mentors. It then became an accelerator, which I'm proud to say was recognized as one of the top 100 accelerators in the world at the time. And then I retired from that to think about what the next gap in the entrepreneurship ecosystem was. And that's what inspired me to start Launch. And for about 17 years, I've been helping to run the River Valley Investors, which is an angel investor network based in Western Massachusetts as well. So I've had a chance to see the entrepreneurial journey from a lot of different perspectives, and it's been very helpful.
It's very easy to talk about one's successes, but we don't often hear about, I don't even want to classify it as a failure, that startup that you had, mm-hmm. that maybe wasn't an overwhelming success. I think there are a lot of lessons for life and for business when things don't go the way you think they're going to go. So what do you bring to it? Probably you bring something to your daily life because of that.
Yeah, human nature being what it is, we learn much more from our failures than we do our successes. And anyone who studied a little bit of statistics knows the concept of survivorship bias, which in plain English means if you bought a lottery ticket and you won money, it's not because buying lottery tickets is a smart strategy for making money. You just got lucky. And so a lot of times when we're successful in life, we assume it's because we're great. But when we fail, as long as we're grown up about it, the reasons for the failure are usually staring us in the face, and we're much more geared up to learn from those. So I have failed many times in my career, and most of the education I've been able to give entrepreneurs, I'm like, don't do that. Why? Because it doesn't work. How do I know? Because I already screwed it up. You don't need to.
Learned it the hard way.
Yeah, exactly. Matter of fact, the best received talk I ever gave was Surviving Failure at my accelerator. We were packed and had all these entrepreneurs at the beginning of their journey, and they want to know what it was like when it doesn't work and when you're laying everyone off, and how do you get through it on the other side, and what led to that and how to avoid it. And those were moments that really made me grow as a human being.
Yeah.
And I think everyone should try to learn from other people's mistakes whenever possible. But if you're screwing up, at least maximize your ROI by noticing why you screwed up and trying to do better.
And it's a learning experience.
It should be. And that's one of the great things about the entrepreneurial community is that the word failure means something very different for us, right? We just see it as a learning. You know, my first company was a financial failure, but it wasn't a failure. We built a product that changed the lives of thousands of blind people around the world. That's something to be incredibly proud about. We built technology that was absolute bleeding edge and did it on a fraction of the budget of what other people could do. I learned a lot about leadership and raising money and so many things. It was, you know, if you go to college, if I had gone to get an MBA, I would have paid a bunch of money to get trained. So I spent a bunch of money, mostly my aunts and uncles' money, but usually you spend your family's money when you go into college to learn how to be a better business person. And so I always tell my entrepreneurs that they should be looking at opportunities to learn. And in fact, the best, you know, lean startup methodology, which I'm sure you guys preach a lot over at the Venture Forum, right, is all about designing it so that your failures are small, When a failure is small, it's called learning. When it's big and it kills you, it's called failure. And that's a distinction. And if you're just making lots of experiments and 80% of them fail, doesn't matter so long as the 20% that work, you know, really work. So can you find the thing that works before you run out of cash?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost like, you know, agile failure, right? So you do it in increments rather than doing it all at once.
Yeah, all at once doesn't work. Talk to anyone who understands risk mitigation strategies in any industry. You know, engineers, single point of failure, don't do that. Portfolio managers, don't bet everything on Coca-Cola stock. You know, this is a lesson. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's probably wisdom that goes back to, you know, the pre-agricultural age,
yeah.
Right? So these are things that we know, but we often forget, and we fall in love with our idea. If you would just give me the money, Mark, you know, my beautiful plan is going to work. All I need is $1 million, and everything's going to go great.
Right.
And that's not how it works.
Yeah, it's an interesting life lesson, too.
Yeah, so when I'm working with entrepreneurs these days in my own startup, Launch 413, we're only 3 years old, right from the get-go, we designed it. Like, we are running experiments. We are doing things on the cheap. I had people telling me in year one, why aren't you raising, you know, a $10 million fund, Paul? I'm like, because I'll lose it all. I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I'm willing to raise $120,000, 1/100th of a small venture fund, because with that, we can really learn a lot of things and prove that we're on the right path. And then no one will be pissed. And I can go back and ask them for money, and I wouldn't have lost all their money already.
Right.
And that's what's happened. You know, every year we've gone out, we raised a tiny amount of money, and we systematically get better results year after year because we've been careful and testing and systematically log. And we do postmortems, you know, every 6 months with our team, what is and isn't working. And we have no shame about it. And it's great. And it's liberating.
Yeah.
To be okay with making mistakes and learning from them and then just not making that mistake again.
Well, and it's so much easier now to make prototypes. Even if you're making physical products, you can prototype far more easily than you could 10, 15, 20 years ago. So you can experiment.
Mark, why, when I was young, we had to build our prototypes uphill, both ways in the snow, and $1 million.
Yeah. No, it's true, right? I mean, you know, with 3D printing, you know, we've got friends of the Venture Forum at Work Lab here in Worcester. And, you know, you can go in there and use their 3D printer to come up with a prototype rather than having a drawing and then sending it out and waiting for it to come back. You can kind of have instant gratification. Oh, I guess that doesn't work.
Yeah. And something I've fallen in love with in the past 18 months, became familiar with this concept that was invented out in Silicon Valley called prototyping. Have you heard it?
Yeah.
Right. You know, so I now help my entrepreneurs like, oh, I want to prototype it. First of all, they always think they need to spend more money on the prototype than they really do.
Yeah.
And then I say, you don't need to build a damn thing. I want to see a PowerPoint presentation that walks me through how this product is supposed to work. I want to see a drawing. I want you to show it to a customer. Like, really? Really? And then sure enough, one of my favorite examples, I built an accelerator that helps nonprofits create for-profit divisions.
So yeah, I want to talk about that later. That's
more money.
Yeah.
And one of our teams came in and they, you know, they're a grown-up, mature nonprofit, hundreds of employees, multiple facilities, yada, yada, yada. Like, we have all these commercial kitchens. We want to make, like, HelloFresh for our population, which is intellectually disabled folks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's a great idea. Interesting. And we just need, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to buy all the special refrigerators and stuff to put all the equipment in place. I'm like, well, what if we, let's see if we can go something cheaper than that. And then they came up with it. What they did is they took cardboard cutouts of food and they put them in a cardboard box and they, you know, did a color printer and made a label for it and put it on the box. And then they got some of their intellectually disabled clients and some of their line-level employees to come into the room as the executives walked in and handed them the box and watched them use it. And within 15 minutes, they knew the idea was colossally stupid.
Uh-huh.
And all it cost them was cardboard.
Yeah.
But then they realized not only was the idea colossally stupid, but what the people really did need, and that actually that was a better idea. And they figured it out with cardboard.
Yeah.
They were proud that they had figured out how to prototype it for, you know, $50,000 instead of the $1 million someone told them. And instead, they did it for 50 cents.
That's amazing. So one of the questions I ask people on this program is, what makes Massachusetts special for you? Do you have a reason that you're out in Western Massachusetts? I'm not sure where you grew up, but you know, what attracted you to the area?
Well, I was born in southeastern Massachusetts, though I work hard to hide the accent. Mostly because when I got to college at UMass Amherst, the girls thought you were stupid. And there are few forces more powerful on 18-year-old males than girls thinking they're stupid. So I learned to drop my accent, though when my mother calls, my wife giggles. So I came out to Western Mass for college. And then the reason I stayed is because people here showered me with love and support to start my company. And there was a very nascent entrepreneurship ecosystem in Western Mass at that point in time. Now there's a much stronger one, and ditto for Central Mass. But in general, Massachusetts is one of the true hotbeds in the country. You know, there's Silicon Valley. New York has an excellent ecosystem. Obviously, Colorado has an excellent ecosystem. But Massachusetts has some of the most incredible resources. And we do even better if we stop thinking that things past 128 aren't Massachusetts.
Right.
And that we're, you know, and that it's okay to work with Vermont or Worcester, God forbid. You know, and so when people do that, and I'd actually say COVID has been a huge help for this, because Boston has generally been very Boston focused. And I get it. When you get that many awesome companies within a 30-minute drive of your office, why are you going to drive any further? But because COVID changed everyone's culture around using video conferencing, the angel groups of New England are very actively working with a much wider geography of companies than they ever did before. Everyone's gotten much more comfortable with startups not having to move to one of the major tech hubs, as startups are now leaving major tech hubs, or significant portions of their workforces are leaving major tech hubs. So I think net, that's going to be a real benefit for you and me in our respective ecosystems, because it's all right around the corner. Whereas if you're in many other parts of the country, there isn't anything that's even remotely connected to you. It's a lot harder to connect in to Boston. But if people in Central and Western Mass are no more than 1 or 2 degrees separation from some of the most incredible resources in the world.
It's a wonderful state and a wonderful innovation environment to be in.
Yeah. We tolerate entrepreneurs around here. We think they're cool, you know? And also, I would say, you know, when one talks about in broad generalities, one must always be careful, you know. But Silicon Valley's culture is beautiful and amazing. The world needs it. But it's different than Boston's. You know, Silicon Valley is more focused on breeding unicorns.
Yeah.
And that kind of hyper growth is necessary to create the Googles and Facebooks of the world. But it creates certain stresses and only allows certain kinds of entrepreneurs to thrive. And New England, you know, us conservative Yankees, that's what the rest of the country calls us, right?
Yeah.
You know, New York doesn't. But us conservative folks, we like a company that makes revenue. We think selling for $100 million is really, really cool. Whereas, you know, you got to get to at least $1 billion before they even pay attention to you. In some other parts of the world. So I like that we're a little bit more grounded. We're big fans of companies that are focused on more fundamental concepts of generating revenue and getting to profitability more quickly. And that appeals to the kind of entrepreneurs I like to work with. It's not that Silicon Valley is worse. It's different and it already exists, so we don't need to be it. So this works better for me.
Yeah. So let's talk about the kind of entrepreneurs you work with at Launch 413.
Yeah. So we are one of the nation's first post accelerators. Because we saw a huge problem that I ran an accelerator, I run an angel group, and I had assumed that, you know, my top students would just go straight from the accelerator into my angel group. But I kept seeing this problem that the angels would turn down these entrepreneurs because they were first-time founders. And quite frankly, they were right. The first-time founders, you know, are going to make first-timer mistakes, and the angels are going to pay the tuition bill for them to learn.
Yeah.
So they would always say, go get some gray hair, you know, and come back. But the problem is, without the money, the entrepreneurs couldn't hire the gray hair. So that was the catch-22.
Yeah.
So that's what inspired us to start Launch. And so therefore, the kind of entrepreneurs we tend to work with are companies that often, though they don't have to, have graduated from an accelerator. So they're past the I have an idea stage. You know, they've done validation. They've identified who their target market is. They've probably got a prototype, or even they're generating their first revenue dollars. But they know, you know, they're often solopreneurs or very small teams. And they know that they don't have all the gray hair that they need. I say gray hair. Of course, it's not about gray hair. You and I both know. It's about life experience, which sometimes you can get by the age of 30. but, you know, they know that they need, that there are gaps in their team that they can't afford to fill. And what they want is to not make my mistakes and your mistakes. So we look for entrepreneurs that are building businesses that can get to at least $3 million in revenue, that they can start generating revenue within a year if they're not already doing so. And that the entrepreneurs are absolutely dedicated to getting coached aggressively. You know, so we liken it to danger. I'm not a sports ball guy, but, you know, the entrepreneur is the quarterback of the football team. They run the plays. They do all the work. But we are the coach making them do the 1,000 push-ups and calling in the nutritionist and saying you got to change your diet.
Yeah.
And we are there kicking their butt every week to help them with the things that they want done so that they can not make our mistakes, stay focused on the right things, and build their company.
So I want to talk a little bit about mentoring. And you were founder of Valley Venture Mentors. What spurred you to get involved in that? And what do you see as the value of mentoring?
Sure. So Valley Venture Mentors was an outgrowth of my work at UMass Amherst, teaching college kids the basics. Like, hey, this is what being a startup is, and here's how to start an idea. So we were really good at ideation. But then we had a bunch of people that had ideas, and they didn't need book knowledge. What they needed was to talk to people that had some experience. You might be seeing a trend in my life. And so the mentoring program was about finding a efficient way to match make between mentor and mentee, because mentors love helping great students, right? There are a few things as satisfying to find a great student who's going to gobble up the knowledge that you have and you make a difference in their life. And in entrepreneurship, you know, when you mentor an entrepreneur and they do well, you don't just help them, which is beautiful. Any of us, we've helped friends and family, right? But if you help an entrepreneur and they do well, then you impact the lives of all their employees and all the people that benefit from their products and services. You can have like a real chain effect,
yeah.
Which is beautiful. So I think that's a big part of what is attractive to people to be a mentor is to see teaching and to have a chance at some real scale. And those entrepreneurs need the real world knowledge, and they're not going to get it from any other source except the school of hard knocks, which they'd like to skip if possible.
Did you have a mentor when you were young?
So many, it is impossible to keep count. And in fact, I often joke with people, I was raised Catholic, so I know a lot about Catholic guilt.
Same here.
My guilt, the karmic debt that I, to mix religious metaphors, the karmic debt that I owe to the many mentors that changed my life cannot even be measured. So whenever I'm helping someone, I'm like, you don't understand. You're like, I have to do this or I'm going to hell. I got to help you to just try to even the odds. But, you know, Eddie Binder has been one of my most incredible mentors in my life. He was a former VP of marketing of Dunkin' Donuts and Spalding Sports. And he was there on my board of that first company and taught me the concept of lovingly critical, which is to tell you that you're doing something wrong, to not pull that punch, but to do it in such a way that, you know, you didn't just get punched in the gut.
Right.
That you can, that this person says it from a position of loving you and wanting you to succeed. And that is a delicate balance to know how to do that. In addition to all the incredible business advice the man taught me, which I can't, you know, we could spend hours just talking about that and I won't bore your audience with it. But above and beyond that, he just knew how to support me. And all the mentoring I have ever done since then, that principle has been at the core. We use that word lovingly critical to guide everyone, to make sure that they're helping the entrepreneur in just the right way.
Oh, that's great. We'll be back in a moment with Paul Silva, and we'll discuss capital, nonprofit sustainability, and, of course, the future. So stay tuned. We are back with Paul Silva. Paul, one of the challenges for our area in central Massachusetts is capital. What do you think it will take to boost capital in my area and in general in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so that is a problem for all of the country that isn't the major tech hubs.
Yeah.
Right? So central Mass and western Mass, Vermont, all have very similar challenges. If we look at the Rise of the Rest movement that Steve Case started, is trying to address some of those very challenges. So, you know, what do we do about it? Well, one, we work hard to try to build a culture around angel investing when we can, which is much easier said than done, because if you don't have a bunch of exited entrepreneurs, in your ecosystem, then it's pretty hard to build an angel group of people that are going to have the risk tolerance to feel comfortable investing in the next generation of entrepreneurs. And because of network effects, most of the people that build big companies moved to one of the major tech hubs to grow their company. And then when they had their exit, well, now their life is already there. So unless they decided to retire or come back to home, then that creates some challenges. But you can leverage whatever assets you do have. You can leverage that the world has changed. So for instance, both you and I are very urban compared to Vermont. And my conversation with Vermont has just blown me away with how well they have done at attracting some killer talent to their ecosystem and some young talent. And then that young talent wants to be angel investors and be involved. So they've solved the problem not by trying to change the minds of the people that were there before, because changing minds is hard, but by very proactively recruiting the great talent that has shown up, the new people, and getting them excited about being a part of it. And leveraging new tools like AngelList and tools like that are making it easier than it's ever been for networks to form and to start funding things. But I think it's also incumbent on people like you and me that run programs that train up entrepreneurs. We need to provide feedstock for the investors. And we have to do a better job of packaging these companies so that they are every bit as attractive and professional looking as they are in Boston, if we want to have any hope of local investors getting comfortable with it, or Boston investors getting comfortable with it and then not insisting that the company relocate to Boston or Austin or Silicon Valley, pick your favorite tech hub.
But does what we talked about earlier about, you know, everybody uses Zoom, that location isn't as important as it used to be? That seems to be a common theme in the COVID economy. Is that going to affect location of companies?
It has had a profound impact. If you listen to the, you know, podcasts or the quiet interviews, or I get to sit in, you know, I'm a member of an angel group in New England, and all of the leaders in New England get together every month and talk about stuff. Right. And in these, you know, virtual rooms, what I am hearing over and over again is, you know, for the first 3 months, it was, gosh darn it, we got to do this on Zoom. And I don't like stinking Zoom, but I got to do it. And then it was, well, you know, there's some benefits to this. And now it's like, hey, so we're really looking forward to seeing each other again. But like, I don't want to lose access to these really cool deals we've been seeing. So how do we make sure to keep seeing these deals from New York or from Vermont? Or, you know, so there has been a change. It's too early to see how much of it really permeates, but there's been some models that have shifted. Like if you look at, say, TBD Angels, that's an angel group that's barely over a year old. And they've done more deals than almost any angel group in New England in the past year. And that's because they were born during this time. They took natively to the format. And they've leveraged the technology, and everyone's just gotten used to the culture. And now I don't know if they can go back. My own angel group switched to being online only, like everyone had to. But then we realized that it was better for us. So I now have members of my angel group from as far away as Texas, because we carved out a particular niche that worked out really well for us. But now we're attracting angels from much further afield. And that means we look at deals from further afield, too. So I think it's going to be easier than it's ever been for non-major tech market hub startups to get the attention of investors and have a fair shot. It's not going to be easy. It's just going to be less hard. And it's up to people like you and me to keep thinking about what we can do on our end to make it easier for those folks to have a place to plug into. They can just call the venture forum and know that they're going to get a curated set of 10 good deals every quarter or something like that. When we can make it easy, then that makes it easier for the other investors to come in. Also for investors that are not very sophisticated. And, you know, in my angel group isn't full of people that have got 5 exits under their belt. It's full of people that work for a living. Yeah. They're affluent, but they don't know how to do due diligence, most of them. So they need it easy. So we've modified our angel group to only bring in deals that are all wrapped up in a bow led by another angel group. But because we do that, we're actually investing. And they like what I'm doing at Launch 413 because, again, post-accelerator, companies come to launch. Launch is finishing school. We get them packaged up, all ready to go. And by the time Launch puts its blessing on a deal and puts it in front of an angel group, the angel groups know, like, oh, well, you know, there's adult supervision on this deal. I hate that term. That's a term a lot of people use. You know, all the terms are professional. They're what we expect. So there's lots of things that people like you and I can be doing to help our entrepreneurs be queued up in the right place at the right time and dressed the right way. Yeah. Unfortunately, to be successful.
This whole location being irrelevant was great when we were putting together mentors for our 5-minute pitch contest, because we didn't have to worry about location. Whether, you know, in a year ago, probably would have wanted everyone in the Worcester area. But this go round, we had people on the North Shore and we had people as far away as Seattle who were working as mentors for our companies. And that was a huge change.
It strikes me that one of the things that we're all going to have to get a lot better at, you know, good news, all the stuff you just said. Bad news, we're now competing with all those other geographies for mentors.
Sure.
And so that means, you know, and we're all good capitalists here, so we respect competition. It makes things better. That means we have to find our niche, you know, so it can be that, oh, I'm a WPI grad and I've got that emotion, I've got that affinity. And that's one thing that you guys have, you know, pick all, you have many colleges in your area. I pick on the one I've been at the most.
Yeah.
So you've got those affinity networks, but also Worcester has this thriving, like I'm telling you, like you don't know, you know, thriving life science and a number of other sectors where it's really good. And so how can you guys be attracting some truly amazing mentors in those sectors or people that used to live here and have an emotional connection? Those are those kinds of things that we're trying to do out here in Western Mass as well.
One of the things I love to do as I wrap up these discussions is think about the future. And at the Venture Forum, we see a bright future in central Massachusetts, not without challenges. You know, the COVID economy has been a big challenge for everyone. But we see opportunities for entrepreneurs in the greater Worcester area. Out where you are, what do you see in the future?
Yeah, predictions about the future are awfully hard. But what I am seeing is that the cultural norms of investors being comfortable doing things on Zoom, of corporations now realizing the benefit of being able to hire people from broader geographies and letting their people move to lower cost, you know, place of living, being able to better retain top talent. We have seen an absolute, you know, real estate prices have skyrocketed in Western Mass.
Yeah.
As people fleeing Boston and New York during the pandemic, you know, came here. And they went to lots of places, but this is one of the places where lots of people landed. And there's a bunch of killer, really talented people who are remote working and living in our backyards now. And I think that that's a resource that all of us need to make sure to include and welcome those people into our community and make them a part of our entrepreneurship ecosystem. That change, the cultural change that we can raise funding better, the cultural change that you can get help from all kinds of resources and everyone's just more literate on these technologies, is really opening the door for a democratization of entrepreneurship. But it also, again, means we're all going to have to get a lot better about specialization. We can't just be, I'm the entrepreneurship program for Region X.
Yeah.
That's valuable, but we probably got to start figuring out what we're even better at.
It's kind of the next iteration of the world is flat. You know, it's more a localized version of that.
I agree.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the Venture Forum, Paul. It was a great discussion.
It was lovely talking to you.
I'm Mark Reed Edwards. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Venture Forum from WICN in Worcester. Join us next week as we continue to share tales of entrepreneurship from Central Massachusetts.